Side 9, Gravity's Rainbow, by Thomas Pynchon. Continuing on page 287. But meantime, the opium deal doesn't look like it's going to come through because the middleman hasn't been heard from in several weeks, along with the money Tamara fronted him, which she got from Raoul de la Perlimpinpin through Waxwing, who is now being pressured by Raoul for the money because Italo, deciding the tank belongs to Tamara now, showed up last night and took it away to an undisclosed location as payment on his loan, thus causing Raoul to panic. Something like that. Clothrop's tale is being made indecent propositions by two of the homosexuals who've been fighting in the bathroom. Bounce and Michelle are nowhere in sight, and neither is that Waxwing. Raoul is talking earnestly to his horse. Clothrop is just settling down next to a girl in a pre-war Worth frock and with a face like Peniel's Alice. Same forehead, nose, hair, when from outside comes this most god-awful clanking, snarling, crunching of wood, girls come running terrified out of the eucalyptus trees and into the house, and right behind them what comes crashing now into the pallid lights of the garden but, why, the Sherman tank itself. Headlights burning like the eyes of King Kong, treads spewing grass and pieces of flagstone as it maneuvers around and comes to a halt. Its 75-millimeter cannon swivels until it's pointing through the French windows right down into the room. "Antoine," a young lady focusing in on the gigantic muzzle, "for heaven's sake, not now." A hatch flies open, and Tamara, Slothrop guesses, wasn't Italo supposed to have the tank, emerges shrieking to denounce Raoul, Waxwing, Italo, Theophile, and the middleman on the opium deal. "But now," she screams, "I have you all, one coup de foudre." The hatch drops. Oh, Jesus, there's the sound of a 3-inch shell being loaded into its breech. Girls start to scream and make for the exits. Dopers are looking around, blinking, smiling, saying yes in a number of ways. Raoul tries to mount his horse and make his escape, but misses the saddle and slides all the way over, falling into a tub of black market jello, raspberry flavor with whipped cream on top. Oh, no, Slothrop, having about decided to make a flanking run for the tank when, iblam! The cannon lets loose an enormous roar, flame shooting 3 feet into the room, shockwave driving eardrums into middle of brain, blowing everybody against the far walls. The drape has caught fire. Clothrop, tripping over partygoers, can't hear anything, knows his head hurts, keeps running through the smoke at the tank, leaps on, goes to undog the hatch, and is nearly knocked off by Tamara popping up to holler at everybody again. After a struggle which shouldn't be without its erotic moments, for Tamara is a swell-enough-looking twist with some fine moves, Slothrop manages to get her in a come-along and drag her down off of the tank. But loud noise and all, look, he doesn't seem to have an erection. This is a datum London never got, because nobody was looking. Turns out the projectile, a dud, has only torn holes in several walls and demolished a large allegorical painting of virtue and vice in an unnatural act. Virtue had one of those dim, faraway smiles. Vice was scratching his shaggy head, a little bewildered. The burning drape's been put out with champagne. Raoul is in tears, thankful for his life, wringing Slothrop's hands and kissing his cheeks, leaving trails of jello wherever he touches. Tamar is escorted away by Raoul's bodyguards. Slothrop has just disengaged himself and is wiping the jello off of his suit when there is a heavy touch on his shoulder. "You were right. You are the man." "That's nothing," Errol Flynn frisks his mustache. "I saved a dame from an octopus not so long ago. How about that?" "With one difference," says Blodgett Waxwing. "This really happened tonight, but that octopus didn't." "How do you know?" "I know a lot. Not everything, but a few things you don't. Listen, Slothrop, you'll be needing a friend, and sooner than you think. Don't come here to the villa. It may be too hot by then, but if you can make it as far as Nice..." He hands over a business card embossed with a chestnut and an address on Rue Rossini. "I'll take the envelope back. Here's your suit. Thanks, brother." He's gone. His talent is just to fade when he wants to. The zoot suit is in a box tied with a purple ribbon. Keychains there, too. They both belong to a kid who used to live in East Los Angeles named Ricky Gutierrez. During the zoot suit riots in 1943, young Gutierrez was set upon by a carload of Anglo vigilantes from Whittier, beaten up while the L.A. police watched and called out advice, then arrested for disturbing the peace. The judge was allowing zoot suitors to choose between jail and the army. Gutierrez joined up, was wounded on Saipan, developed gangrene, had to have his arm amputated, is home now, married to a girl who works in the kitchen at a taco place in San Gabriel, can't find any work himself, drinks a lot during the day. But his old zoot and those of thousands of others busted that summer, hanging empty on the backs of all the Mexican L.A. doors, got bought up and have found their way over here, into the market, no harm, turning a little profit, is there? They'd only have hung there in the fat smoke and the baby smell, in the rooms with shades pulled down against the white sun beating day after day on the dried palm trees and muddy culverts inside these fly-ridden and empty rooms. Imipolex G has proved to be nothing more or less sinister than a new plastic, an aromatic heterocyclic polymer developed in 1939, years before its time, by one L. Jampf for I.G. Farben. It is stable at high temperatures, like up to 900 degrees centigrade, it combines good strength with a low power loss factor. Structurally, it's a stiffened chain of aromatic rings, hexagons like the gold one that slides and taps above Hillary Bounce's navel, alternating here and there with what are known as heterocyclic rings. The origins of Imipolex G are traceable back to early research done at DuPont. Plasticity has its grand tradition and mainstream, which happens to flow by way of DuPont and their famous employee, Carruthers, known as the Great Synthesist. His classic study of large molecules spanned the decade of the 20s and brought us directly to nylon, which not only is a delight to the fetishist and a convenience to the armed insurgent, but was also, at the time and well within the system, an announcement of plasticity's central canon, that chemists were no longer to be at the mercy of nature. They could decide now what properties they wanted a molecule to have and then go ahead and build it. At DuPont, the next step after nylon was to introduce aromatic rings into the polyamide chain. Pretty soon a whole family of aromatic polymers had arisen. Aromatic polyamides, polycarbonates, polyethers, polysulfanes. The target property most often seemed to be strength. First among plasticity's virtuous triad of strength, stability, and whiteness. Kraft, Standfestigkeit, Weiße. How often these were taken for Nazi graffiti, and indeed how indistinguishable they commonly were on the rain-brightened walls as the buses clashed gears in the next street over and the trams creaked of metal and the people were mostly silent in the rain, with the early evening darkened to the texture of smoke from a pipe and the arms of young passers-by not in the sleeves of their coats but inside somewhere as if sheltering midgets, or ecstatically drifted away from the timetable into a tactile affair with linings more seductive even than the new nylon. L. Jampf, among others, then proposed, logically, dialectically, taking the parental polyamide sections of the new chain and looping them around into rings too, giant heterocyclic rings to alternate with the aromatic rings. This principle was easily extended to other precursor molecules. A desired monomer of high molecular weight could be synthesized to order, bent into its heterocyclic ring, clasped, and strung in a chain along with the more natural benzene or aromatic rings. Such chains would be known as aromatic heterocyclic polymers. One hypothetical chain that Jampf came up with just before the war was later modified into Imipolex G. Jampf at the time was working for a Swiss outfit called Psychochemie AG, originally known as the Grössli Chemical Corporation, a spin-off from Sandoz, where, as every schoolchild knows, the legendary Dr. Hoffmann made his important discovery. In the early 20s, Sandoz, Siba, and Geigy had got together in a Swiss chemical cartel. Shortly after, Jampf's firm was also absorbed. Apparently, most of Grössli's contracts had been with Sandoz anyway. As early as 1926, there were real oral agreements between the Swiss cartel and IG Farben. When the Germans set up their cover company in Switzerland, IG Chemie, 2 years later, a majority of the Grössli stock was sold to them, and the company reconstituted as Psychochemie AG. The patent for Imipolex G was thus cross-filed for both the IG and for Psychochemie. Shell Oil got into it through an agreement with Imperial Chemicals dated 1939. For some curious reason, Slothrop will discover no agreements between ICI and the IG seem to be dated any later than 39. In this Inipolex agreement, ICI could market the new plastic inside the Commonwealth in exchange for £1 and other good and valuable consideration. That's nice. Psychochemie AG is still around, still doing business at the same old address in the Schokoladestrasse in that Zurich, Switzerland. Clothrop swings the long keychain of his zoot in some agitation. A few things are immediately obvious. There is even more being zeroed in on him from out there than he'd thought, even in his most paranoid spells. Emipolex G shows up on a mysterious insulation device on a rocket being fired with the help of a transmitter on the roof of the headquarters of Dutch Shell, who is co-licensee for marketing the Emipolex, a rocket whose propulsion system bears an uncanny resemblance to one developed by British Shell at around the same time. And oh boy, it just occurs to Slothrop now where all the rocket intelligence is being gathered. Into the office of who but Mr. Duncan Sands, Churchill's own son-in-law, who works out of the Ministry of Supply, located where but at Shell Mech's house, for Christ's sake. Here Schlothrop stages a brilliant commando raid, along with faithful companion Bludget Waxwing, on Shell Mech's house itself, right into the heart of the rocket's own branch office in London. Mowing down platoons of heavy security with his little sten, kicking aside nubile and screaming rack secretaries, how else is there to react, even in play, savagely looting files, throwing Molotov cocktails, the zoot suit zanies at last crashing into the final sanctum with their trousers up around their armpits, smelling singed hair, spilled blood, to find not Mr. Duncan Sands cowering before their righteousness, nor open window, gypsy flight, scattered fortune cards, nor even a test of wills with the great consortium itself. But only a rather dull room. Business machines arrayed around the walls, calmly blinking. Files of cards pierced, frail as sugar faces, frail as the last German walls, standing without support after the bombs have been and now twisting high above, threatening to fold down out of the sky from the force of the wind that has blown the smoke away. The smell of firearms is in the air, and there's not an office dame in sight. The machines chatter and ring to each other. It's time to snap down your brims, share a post-violent cigarette, and think about escape. Do you remember the way in, all the twists and turns? No, you weren't looking. Any of these doors might open you to safety, but there may not be time. But Duncan Sands is only a name, a function in this how high does it go is not even the right kind of question to be asking, because the organization charts have all been set up by them, the titles and names filled in by them, because Proverbs for Paranoids 3. If they can get you asking the wrong questions, they don't have to worry about answers. Lothrop finds he has paused in front of the blue parts list that started all this. How high does it go? Ah. The treacherous question is not meant to apply to people, after all, but to the hardware. Squinting, moving a finger carefully down the columns, Lothrop finds that Vorrichtung für die Isolierung's next higher assembly. Es Gerät 11/00000. If this number is the serial number of a rocket, as its form indicates, it must be a special model. Slothrop hasn't even heard of any with four zeros, let alone five, nor an S-Gerät either. There's an I-dash and a J-Gerät. They're in the guidance. Well, document SG-1, which isn't supposed to exist, must cover that. Out of the room. Going no place special, moving to a slow drumbeat in his stomach muscles. See what happens. Be ready. In the casino restaurant, not the slightest impedance at all to getting in, no drop in temperature perceptible to his skin, Slothrop sits down at a table where somebody has left last Tuesday's London Times. Hasn't seen one of them in a while. Leafing through, dum-dum-dee-doo, yeah, the war is still on, allies closing in east and west on Berlin, powdered eggs still going 1 in 3 a dozen, fallen officers, McGregor, Mucker Maffick, White Street, personal tributes. Meet me in St. Louis, showing at the Empire Cinema. Recalls doing the penis in the popcorn box routine there with one Madeline who was less than... Tantivy. Oh, shit, no, wait. True charm, humble-mindedness, strength of character, fundamental Christian cleanness and goodness. We all loved Oliver. His courage, kindness of heart, and unfailing good humor were an inspiration to all of us. Died bravely in battle, leading a gallant attempt to rescue members of his unit who were pinned down by German artillery. and signed by his most devoted comrade in arms, Theodore Bloat. Major Theodore Bloat now. Staring out the window, staring at nothing. Gripping a table knife so hard maybe some bones of his hand will break. It happens sometimes to lepers. Failure of feedback to the brain. No way to know how fiercely they may be making a fist. You know these lepers. Well, 10 minutes later, back up in his room, he's lying face down on the bed, feeling empty. Can't cry, can't do anything. They did it. Took his friend out to some death trap. Probably let him fake an honorable death and then just closed up his file. It will occur to him later that maybe the whole story was a lie. They could have planted it easy enough in that London Times, couldn't they? Left the paper for Slothrop to find. But by the time he figures that one out, there'll be no turning around. At noon, Hilary Bounce comes in, rubbing his eyes, wearing a shit-eating grin. How was your evening? Mine was remarkable. Glad to hear it. Slothrop is smiling. You're on my list too, pal. This smile asks from him more grace than anything in his languid American life ever has up till now. Grace he always imagined himself short on, but it's working. He's surprised, and so grateful that he almost starts crying then. The best part of all is not that Bounce appears fooled by the smile, but that Slothrop knows now that it will work for him again. So he does make it to Nice. After a fast escape down the Corniche, through the mountains fishtailing and rubber softly screeching at the sun-warmed abysses, tails all shaken back on the beach where he was thoughtful enough to lend his buddy Claude, the assistant chef, about the same height and build, his own brand-new pseudo-Tahitian bathing trunks, and while they're all watching that Claude find a black Citroën with the keys left in, nothing to it, folks, rolling into town in his white zoot, dark glasses, and a flopping Sydney Green Street Panama hat. He's not exactly inconspicuous among the crowds of military and the mamselles already shifted into summer dresses, but he ditches the car off Place Garibaldi, heads for a bistro on the old Nice side of La Porte Fosse, and takes time to nab a roll and coffee before setting out to find the address Waxwing gave him. It turns out to be an ancient four-story hotel with early drunks lying in the hallways, eyelids like tiny loaves brushed with the last glaze of setting sun, and summertime dust and stately evolutions through the taupe light, summertime ease to the streets outside, April summertime as the great vortex of redeployment from Europe to Asia hoots past, leaving many souls each night to cling a bit longer to the tranquillities here, this close to the drain hole of Marseille, this next to last stop on the paper cyclone that sweeps them back from Germany, down the river valleys beginning to drag some from Antwerp and the northern ports too now as the vortex grows more sure as preferential paths are set up. Just for the knife edge, here in the Rue Rossini, there comes to Slothrop the best feeling dusk in a foreign city can bring. Just where the sky's light balances the electric lamplight in the street, just before the first star, some promise of events without cause, surprises, a direction at right angles to every direction his life has been able to find up till now. Too impatient to wait for the first star, Slothrop enters the hotel. The carpets are dusty, the place smells of alcohol and bleach. Sailors and girls come ambling through, together and separate, as Slothrop paranoid from door to door, looking for one that might have something to tell him. Radios play in the heavy wood rooms. The stairwell doesn't appear to be plumb, but tilted at some peculiar angle, and the light running down the walls is of only two colors, earth and leaf. Up on the top floor, Slothrop finally spots an old motherly femme de chambre on the way into a room carrying a change of linen, very white in the gloom. Why did you leave? The sad whisper ringing as if through a telephone receiver from someplace far away. They wanted to help you. They wouldn't have done anything bad. Her hair is rolled up, George Washington style, all the way around. She gazes at 45 degrees to Slothrop, a patient park bench chess player's gaze, very large, arching, kindly nose and bright eyes. She is starch, sure-boned. The toes of her leather shoes turn up slightly. She's wearing red and white striped socks on enormous feet that give her the look of a helpful critter from one of the other worlds. The sort of elf who'd not only make shoes while you slept, but also sweep up a little, have the pot on when you awoke, and maybe a fresh flower by the window. I beg your pardon? There's still time. You don't understand. They've killed a friend of mine. But seeing it in the Times that way, so public, how could any of that be real? Real enough to convince him Tantivy won't just come popping in the door someday. Howdy, folks, and a bashful smile. Hey, Tantivy, where were you? Where was I, Slothook? That's a good one. His smile lighting the time again and the world all free. He flashes Waxwing's card. The old woman breaks into an amazing smile, the two teeth left in her head under the night's new bulbs. She thumbs him upstairs and then gives him either the V for victory sign or some spell from distant countryside against the evil eye that sours the milk. Whichever it is, she is chuckling sarcastically. Upstairs is a roof, a kind of penthouse in the middle. Three young men with Apache sideburns and a young woman packing a braided leather sap are sitting in front of the entrance, smoking a thin cigarette of ambiguous odor. You are lost, mon ami. Out with Waxwing's card again. Ah, bien. They roll aside and he passes into a bickering of canary yellow borsellini. Cork-soled comic book shoes with enormous round toes. A lot of that saddle stitching and contrasting colors such as orange on blue and the perennial favorite green on magenta. Workaday groans of comforted annoyance commonly heard in public toilets. Telephone traffic inside clouds of cigar smoke. Waxwing isn't in, but a colleague interrupts some loud dealing soon as he sees the card. What do you need? Carte d'identité, passage to Zurich, Switzerland. Tomorrow. Place to sleep? The man hands over a key to one of the rooms downstairs. Do you have any money? Not much. I don't know when I could... Count, squint, riffle. Here. It's all right. It's not a loan. It comes out of overhead. Now, don't go outside, don't get drunk. Stay away from the girls who work here. See you tomorrow. Back to business. Slothrop's night passes uncomfortably. There is no position he can manage to sleep in for more than 10 minutes. The bugs sally out onto his body in skirmish parties, not uncoordinated with his level of wakefulness. Drunks come to the door, drunks and revenants. Roan, you've got to let me in. It's Dumpster Villard. What's that? It's really bad tonight. I'm sorry. I shouldn't impose this way. I'm more trouble than I'm worth. Listen, I'm cold. I've been a long way. A sharp knock. Dumpster. No, it's Murray Smile. I was next to you in Basic Company 84. Remember, our serial numbers are only 2 digits apart. I had to let Dumpster in. Where'd he go? Was I asleep? Don't tell him I was here. I just came to tell you. You don't have to go back. Really? Did they say it was all right? It's all right. Yeah, but did they say it was? Silence. Hey, Murray? Silence. The wind is blowing in the ironwork very strong, and down in the street a vegetable crate bounces end over end, wooden, empty, dark. It must be 4 in the morning. Got to get back. Shit, I'm late. No. Only a whisper, but it was her no that stayed with him. Who's that? Jenny? That you, Jenny? Yes, it's me. Oh, love, I'm so glad I found you. But I have to... Will they ever let her live with him at the casino? No, I can't. But what's wrong with her voice? Jenny, I heard your block was hit. Somebody told me the day after New Year's, a rocket. And I meant to go back and see if you were all right, but I just didn't. And then they took me to that casino. It's all right. But not if I didn't. Just don't go back to them. And somewhere, dark fish hiding past angles of refraction in the flow tonight are Katya and Tantivy, the two visitors he wants most to see. He tries to bend the voices that thumb to the door, bend them like notes on a harmonica, but it won't work. What he wants lies too deep. Just before dawn, knocking comes very loud, hard as steel. Slothrop has the sense this time to keep quiet. Come on, open up! MPs, open up! American voices, country voices, high-pitched and without mercy. He lies freezing, wondering if the bedsprings will give him away. For possibly the first time he is hearing America as it must sound to a non-American. Later he will recall that what surprised him most was the fanaticism, the reliance not just on flat force, but on the rightness of what they planned to do. He'd been told long ago to expect this sort of thing from Nazis, and especially from Japs. We were the ones who always played fair. But this pair outside the door now are as demoralizing as a close-up of John Wayne, the angle emphasizing how slanted his eyes are, funny you never noticed before, screaming, Banzai! Wait a minute, Ray, there he goes. Hopper, you asshole, come back here. You'll never get me in a straitjacket again. Hopper's voice goes fading around the corner as the MPs take off in pursuit. It dawns on Slothrop, literally, through the yellow-brown window shade, that this is his first day outside. His first free morning. He doesn't have to go back. free? What's free? He falls asleep at last. A little before noon, a young woman let herself in with a passkey and leaves him the papers. He is now an English war correspondent named Ian Scuffling. This is the address of one of our people in Zurich. Waxwing wishes you good luck and asks what kept you so long. You mean he wants an answer? He said you'd have to think about it. Say, it's just occurred to him, why are all you folks helping me like this, for free and all? Who knows? We have to play the patterns. There must be a pattern you're in right now. But she's already left. Clothrop looks around the place. In the daylight, it's mean and anonymous. Even the roaches must be uncomfortable here. Is he off so quickly, like Katya on her wheel, off on a ratchet of rooms like this, to be in each one only long enough to gather wind or despair enough to move on to the next, but no way backward now ever again? No time even to get to know the Rue Rossini? Which faces holler from the windows? Where's a good place to eat? What's the name of the song everybody's whistling these premature summer days? A week later, he's in Zurich, after a long passage by train. While the metal creatures in their solitude, days of snug and stable fog, pass the hours at mime, at playing molecules, imitating industrial synthesis as they are broken up, put together, coupled and recoupled, he dozes in and out of a hallucination of Alps, fogs, abysses, tunnels, bone-deep laborings up impossible grades, cowbells in the darkness, in the morning green banks, smells of wet pasture, always out the windows, an unshaven work crew on the way to repair some stretch of track, long waits in marshalling yards whose rails run like layers of an onion cut end to end, gray and desolate places, nights of whistles, coupling, crashes, sidings, staring cows on the evening hillsides, army convoys waiting at the crossings as the train puffs by, never a clear sense of nationality anywhere. Nor even of belligerent sides, only the war, a single damaged landscape in which neutral Switzerland is a rather stuffy convention, observed but with as much sarcasm as liberated France or totalitarian Germany, fascist Spain, and others. The war has been reconfiguring time and space into its own image. The track runs in different networks now. What appears to be destruction is really the shaping of railroad spaces to other purposes, intentions he can only, riding through it for the first time, begin to feel the leading edges of. He checks into the Hotel Nimbus in an obscure street in the Niederdorf or cabaret section of Zurich. The room's in an attic and is reached by ladder. There's also a ladder outside the window, so he reckons it'll be okay. When night comes down, he goes out looking for the local waxwing rep, finds him farther up the Limmat Quay under a bridge, in rooms full of Swiss watches, clocks, and altimeters. He's a Russian named Semyavin. Outside, boats hoot on the river and the lake. Somebody upstairs is practicing on a piano, stumbling, sweet leader. Semyavin pours gentian brandy into cups of tea he's just brewed. First thing you have to understand is the way everything here is specialized. If it's watches, you go to one cafe. If it's women, you go to another. Furs are subdivided into sable, ermine, mink, and others. Same with dope, stimulants, depressants, psychomimetics. What is it you're after? Information? Gee, this stuff tastes like moxie. Oh, another one. Giving Slothrop a sour look. Life was simple before the First War. You wouldn't remember. Drugs, sex, luxury items. Currency in those days was no more than a sideline, and the term industrial espionage was unknown. But I've seen it change. Oh, how it's changed. The German inflation, that should have been my clue right there. Zero strong end-to-end from here to Berlin. Would have stern talks with myself. Semyavin, it's only a temporary lapse away from reality. A small aberration. Nothing to worry about. Act as you always have. Strength of character, good mental health. Courage, Semyavin. Soon all will be back to normal, but you know what? Let me guess. A tragic sigh. Information. What's wrong with dope and women? Is it any wonder the world's gone insane with information come to be the only real medium of exchange? I thought it was cigarettes. You dream. He brings out a list of Zurich cafes and gathering spots. Under espionage, industrial, Slothrop finds three. Ultra, Lichtspiel, and Stregeli. They are on both banks of the Limmat and widely spaced. Footwork, folding the list in an oversized zoot suit pocket.
It'll get easier. Someday it'll all be done by machine, information machines. You are the wave of the future.
Begins a period of shuttling among the three cafes, sitting a few hours over coffee at each one, eating once a day, Zurich bologna and rösti at the people's kitchens, watching crowds of businessmen in blue suits, sun-black skiers who've spent the duration shushing miles of glacier and snow, hearing nothing of campaigns or politics, reading nothing but thermometers and weather vanes, finding their atrocities in avalanches or toppling seracs, their victories in layers of good powder, ragged foreigners in oil-stained leather jackets and tattered fatigues, South Americans bundled in fur coats and shivering in the clear sunlight, elderly hypochondriacs who were caught out lounging at some spa when the war began and have been here since, women in long black dresses who don't smile, men in soiled overcoats who do, and the mad down from their fancy asylums on weekend furlough. Oh, the mental cases of Switzerland. Slothrop is known to them, all right, among all the somber street faces and colors, only he is wearing white. Shoes, zoot, and hat, white as the cemetery mountains here. He's also the new mark in town. It's difficult for him to sort out the first wave of corporate spies from the loonies on leave. The chorus line is divided not into the conventional boys and girls, but into keepers and nuts. Without regard to sex, though all four possibilities are represented on stage. Many are wearing sunglasses with black lenses and white rims, not so much to be fashionable as to suggest snow blindness, the antiseptic white of the clinic, perhaps even the darkness of the mind. But all seems happy, relaxed, informal. No sign of repression, not even a distinction in costume, so that at first there is some problem telling nuts from keepers as they all burst in from the wings, dancing and singing. Here we come, folks, ready or not. Put your mask on and plot your plot. We're just laughing and drooling all over the sleigh like a bunch of happy midgets on a holiday. Oh, we're the loonies on leave, and we haven't a care. Our brains at the cleaners, our souls at the fair. Just freaks on a furlough, away from the blues, as daffy and sharp as the taps on our shoes. Hey, we're passing the hat for your frowns and your tears. And the fears you thought would never go away, oh, take it from a loony, life so dear and swoony, so just hug it and kiss it today. La-da-da, yata, yata-ta-ta, etc. They go on humming the tune behind what follows. First nut, or maybe keeper. Got an amazing deal for you here, American. I thought so. Always tell a face from home, say, like your suit there, go far enough up the glacier and nobody'd be able to see it. Well, yes, now, I know how you feel about these street vendors keep coming by. It's the old three-card Monty on the sidewalk. Trucks across the stage for a while, back and forth, waving his finger in the air, singing three-card Monty on the sidewalk, over and over in the same obsessive monotone for as many repetitions as he can get away with. And you can spot right away what's wrong. Everyone promises you something for nothing, right? Yes, now, oddly enough, that's the main objection engineers and scientists have always had to the idea of, lowering his voice, perpetual motion, or as we like to call it, entropy management. Here's our card. Well, sure, they've got a point. At least they had a point up till now. Second nut or keeper. Now, you've heard about the 200-mile-per-gallon carburetor, the razor edge that never gets dull, the eternal boot sole, the mange pill that's good to your glands, engine that'll run on sand, ornithopters and robobopsters. You heard me. Got a little goatee made out of steel wool. Jivey, that's fine, but here's one for your mind. Are you ready? It's Lightning Latch, the door that opens you.
Slothrop, think I'll go take my nap now.
Third N or K. Transmogrify common air into diamonds through cataclysmic carbon dioxide reduction. If he were sensitive about such things, it'd all be pretty insulting, this first wave. It passes, gesturing, accusative, pleading. Slothrop manages to stay calm. There is a pause. Then on come the real ones, slowly at first, but gathering, synthetic rubber or gasoline, electronic calculators, aniline dyes, acrylics, perfumes, stolen essences in vials in sample cases, sexual habits of 100 selected board members, layouts of plants, code books, connections and payoffs. Ask for it, they can get it. At last, one day at the Stregley, Lothrop eating on a bratwurst and hunk of bread he's been toting around all morning in a paper bag, suddenly from no place appears one Mario Schweitzer in a green frogged waistcoat. Just popped out of the echoing cuckoo clock of WW2 here, the endless dark corridors at his back with a change of luck for Lothrop.
Psst, Joe, he begins. Hey, mister.
Not me, replies Lothrop with his mouth full.
You interested in some LSD?
That stands for pounds, shillings, and pence. You got the wrong cafe, Ace.
I think I've got the wrong country, Schweitzer, a little mournful. I'm from Sandoz.
Aha, Sandoz, cries Lothrop and pulls out a chair for the fella. Turns out Schweitzer is very tight indeed with Psychochemie AG, being one of those free-floating troubleshooters around the cartel, working for them on a per diem basis and spying on the side. Well, Lothrop says, I'd sure like anything they got on El Yamf, and on that Imipolex G.
Gah!
Pardon me?
That stuff, forget it. It's not even our line. You ever tried to develop a polymer when there's nothing but indole people around? With our giant parent to the north sending in ultimatums every day, Imipolex G is the company albatross, Yank. They have vice presidents whose only job is to observe the ritual of going out every Sunday to spit on old Yamf's grave. You haven't spent much time with the Indole crowd. They're very elitist. They see themselves at the end of a long European dialectic. Generations of blighted grain, ergotism, witches on broomsticks, community orgies, cantons lost up there in folds of mountain that haven't known an unhallucinated day in the last 500 years. Keepers of a tradition, aristocrats.
Wait a minute. Yamf dead?
You say Yamf's grave now?
It ought to be making more of a difference to him, except that the man was never really alive, so how can he be really
up in the mountains toward the Uetliberg? You ever...
What? Did you ever meet him?
Before my time, but I know that there's a lot of data on him in the classified files at Sandoz. It would be some job getting you what you want.
500.
500 what?
Swiss francs. Slothrop hasn't got 500 anything unless it's worries. The money from Nice is almost gone. He heads towards Semyavin's across the Gemüsebrücke, deciding he'll walk everywhere from now on, chewing his white sausage and wondering when he'll see another.
First thing you want to do, Semyavin advises him, is go to a pawn shop and raise a few francs on that,
pointing to the suit.
Oh, no, not the suit.
Semyavin goes rummaging in a back room, comes out with a bundle of workmen's clothes.
You should start thinking more about your visibility. Come back tomorrow, see what else I can find.
White Zoot, in a bundle under his arm, a less visible Ian scuffling, goes back outside, down into the medieval afternoon of the Niederdorf, stone walls now developing like baking bread in the failing sun. Oh, boy, he can see it now. Gonna turn into another of them Tamara Italo drills here, and then he'll be in so deep he'll just never get out. At the entrance to his street, in the wells of shadow, he notes a black Rolls parked, motor idling. It's glass-tinted, and afternoon so dark he can't see inside. Nice car. First one he's seen in a while, should be no more than a curiosity, except for Proverbs for Paranoids 4. You hide, they seek.
Zung, dilung, dilatatatayatatata.
William Tell Overture here, back in the shadows, hope nobody was looking through that one-way glass. Zoom, zoom, dodging around corners, scooting down alleys, no sound of pursuit, but then it's the quietest engine on the road except for the King Tiger tank. Forget that Hotel Nimbus, he reckons. His feet are already starting to bother him. He gets to the Luisenstrasse and the Huck shop just before closing time and manages to raise a little baloney for a day or two, maybe, on the Zoot. So long, Zoot. This town sure closes up early. What does Slothrop do tonight for a bed? He has a moment's relapse into optimism, ducks in a restaurant, and rings up the desk at the Hotel Nimbus.
Ah, yes, English, English. Can you possibly tell me if the British chap who's been waiting in the foyer is still there, you know?
In a minute on comes a pleasant, awkward voice with an, "Are you there?" Oh, so seraphic. Slothrop funks, hangs up, stands looking at all the people at dinner staring at him.
Blew it. Blew it. Now they know he's on to them.
There is the usual chance his paranoia's just out of hand again, but the coincidences are running too close. Besides, he knows the sound of their calculated innocence by now. It's part of their style. Out again in the city, precision banks, churches, Gothic doorways drilling by. He must avoid the hotel and the three cafes now. Right, right. The permanent Zürchers in early evening blue stroll by. Blue as the city twilight, deepening blue. The spies and dealers have all gone indoors.
Semyavin's place is out. The Waxwing Circle have been kind. No point bringing any heat down on them. How much weight do the visitors have in this town? Can Slothrop risk checking into another hotel? Probably not. It's getting cold. A wind is coming in now off the lake. He finds that he has drifted as far as the Odeon, one of the great world cafes whose specialty is not listed anywhere. Indeed, has never been pinned down. Lenin, Trotsky, James Joyce, Dr. Einstein all sat out at these tables. Whatever it was they all had in common, whatever they'd come to this vantage to score, perhaps it had to do with the people somehow, with pedestrian mortality. Restless crisscrossing of needs or desperations in one fateful piece of street. Dialectics, matrices, archetypes all need to connect once in a while back to some of that proletarian blood. To body odors and senseless screaming across a table, to cheating and last hopes, or else all is dusty dracularity, the West's ancient curse. Slothrop finds he has enough spare change for coffee. He goes, sits inside, choosing a seat that'll face the entrance. 15 minutes, and he's getting the spy sign from a swarthy, curly-headed alien in a green suit a couple tables away, another front-facer. On his table is an old newspaper that appears to be in Spanish. It is open to a peculiar political cartoon of a line of middle-aged men wearing dresses and wigs inside the police station where a cop is holding a loaf of white... No, it's a baby, with a label on its diaper says La Revolution. Oh, they're all claiming the infant revolution as their own, all these politicians bickering like a bunch of putative mothers. And somehow this cartoon here is supposed to be some kind of a touchstone. This fella in the green suit, who turns out to be an Argentine named Francisco Squalidozzi, is looking for a reaction. The key passage is at the very end of the line where the great Argentine poet Leopoldo Lugones is saying, "Now I'm going to tell you in verse how I conceived her free from the stain of original sin." It is the Uriburu Revolution of 1930. The paper is 15 years old. There is no telling what Squalidozzi is expecting from Slothrop, but what he gets is pure ignorance. This seems to be acceptable, and presently the Argentine has loosened up enough to confide that he and a dozen colleagues, among them the international eccentric Graciela Imago Portales, hijacked an early vintage German U-boat in Mar del Plata a few weeks ago, and have sailed it back across the Atlantic now to seek political asylum in Germany as soon as the war is over there. You say Germany? You gone goofy? It's a mess there, Jackson. Not nearly the mess we left back home, the sad Argentine replies. Long lines have appeared next to his mouth, lines learned from living next to thousands of horses, watching too many doomed colts and sunsets south of Rivadavia, where the true south begins. It's been a mess since the colonels took over. Now with Perón on his way, our last hope was Acción Argentina. What's he talking about? Jesus, I'm hungry. Suppressed it a month after the coup. Now everybody waits, attending the street actions out of habit. No real hope. We decided to move before Perón got another portfolio. War, most likely. He already has the descamisados. This will give him the army, too, you see. It's only a matter of time. We could have gone to Uruguay, waited him out. It's a tradition, but perhaps he will be in for a long time. Montevideo is swarming with failed exiles and failed hopes. Yeah, but Germany, that's the last place you want to go. Pero que no sos argentino. A long look away, down the engineered scars of Swiss avenues, looking for the south he left. Not the same Argentine, Slothrop, that Bob Eberle's seen toasts to tangerine raised in every bar across. Now, Squalidozzi wants to say, we of all magical precipitates out of Europe's groaning, clouded alembic, we are the thinnest, the most dangerous, the handiest to secular uses. We tried to exterminate our Indians like you. We wanted the closed white version of reality we got, but even into the smokiest labyrinths, the furthest stacked density of midday balcony or courtyard and gate, the land has never let us forget. But what he asks aloud is, here, you look hungry. Have you eaten? I was about to go to supper. Would you do me the honor? In the Kronenhalle, they find a table upstairs. The evening rush is tapering off. Sausages and fondue. Trothrop's starving. In the days of the gauchos, my country was a blank piece of paper. The pampas stretched as far as men could imagine, inexhaustible, fenceless. Wherever the gaucho could ride, that place belonged to him. But Buenos Aires sought hegemony over the provinces. All the neuroses about property gathered strength and began to infect the countryside. Fences went up, and the gaucho became less free. It is our national tragedy. They are obsessed with building labyrinths where before there was open plain and sky. To draw ever more complex patterns on the blank sheet. We cannot abide that openness. It is terror to us. Look at Borges. Look at the suburbs of Buenos Aires. The tyrant Rosas has been dead a century, but his cult flourishes. Beneath the city streets, the warrens of rooms and corridors, the fences and the networks of steel track, the Argentine heart, in its perversity and guilt, longs for a return to that first unscribbled serenity, that anarchic oneness of pampas and sky. But Bob Wire, Slothrop with his mouth full of that fondue just gobbling away, that's progress. You can't have open range forever. You can't just stand in the way of progress. Yes, he is actually going to go on for half an hour, quoting Saturday afternoon Western movies dedicated to property, if anything is, at this foreigner who's springing for his meal. Squalidozzi, taking it for mild insanity instead of rudeness, only blinks once or twice. In ordinary times, he wants to explain, the center always wins. Its power grows with time, and that can't be reversed, not by ordinary means. Decentralizing back toward anarchism needs extraordinary times. This war, this incredible war, just for the moment has wiped out the proliferation of little states that's prevailed in Germany for 1,000 years. Wiped it clean, opened it. Sure, for how long? It won't last, of course not, but for a few months. Perhaps there'll be peace by the autumn. Disculpeme, the spring. I still haven't got used to your hemisphere for a moment of spring, perhaps. Yeah, but what are you going to do, take over land and try to hold it? They'll run you right off, partner. No, taking land is building more fences. We want to leave it open. We want it to grow, to change. In the openness of the German zone, our hope is limitless. Then, as if struck on the forehead, a sudden fast glance, not at the door, but up at the ceiling. So is our danger. The U-boat right now is cruising around somewhere off of Spain, staying submerged for much of the day, spending nights on the surface to charge batteries, sneaking in now and then to refuel. Squalidozzi won't go into the fueling arrangements in much detail, but there are apparently connections of many years standing with the Republican underground, a community of grace, a gift of persistence. Squalidozzi is in Zurich now, contacting governments that might be willing, for any number of reasons, to assist his anarchism in exile. He must get a message to Geneva by tomorrow. From there, word is relayed to Spain and the submarine. But there are Peronist agents here in Zurich. He is being watched. He can't risk betraying the contact in Geneva. I can help you out, Slothrop, licking off his fingers, but I'm short of cash and... Squalidozzi names a sum that will pay off Mario Schweitzer and keep Slothrop fed for months to come. Half in front and I'm on the way. The Argentine hands over message, addresses, money, and springs for the check. They arrange to meet at the Kronenhalle in 3 days. Good luck. You too. A last sad look from Squalidozzi alone at his table. A toss of forelock, a fading of light. The plane is a battered DC-3. Chosen for its affinity for moonlight, the kind expression on its windowed face, its darkness inside and outside. He wakes up curled among the cargo, metal darkness, engine vibration through his bones, red light filtering very faint back through a bulkhead from up forward. He crawls to a tiny window and looks out, Alps in the moonlight, kind of small ones, though not as spectacular as he figured on. Oh, well. He settles back down on a soft Excelsior bed, lighting up one of Squalidozzi's cork tips, thinking, jeepers, not bad. Guys just jump in the airplane, go where they want. Why stop at Geneva? Sure, what about, well, that's Spain. No, wait, they're fascists. South Sea Islands. Full of Japs and GIs. Well, Africa's the dark continent. Nothing there but natives, elephants, and that Spencer Tracy. There's nowhere to go, Slothrop, nowhere. The figure is huddled against a crate and shivering. Slothrop squints through the weak red light. It is the well-known frontispiece face of insouciant adventurer Richard Halliburton, but strangely altered. Down both the man's cheeks runs a terrible rash, palimpsested over older pockmarks in whose symmetry Slothrop, had he a medical eye, could have read drug reaction. Richard Halliburton's jodhpurs are torn and soiled, his bright hair greasy now and hanging. He appears to be weeping silently, bending, a failed angel, over all these second-rate Alps, over all the night skiers far below,
out on the slopes, crisscrossing industriously, purifying and perfecting their fascist ideal of action, 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 once his own shining reason for being. No more. No more. Clothard reaches, puts the cigarette out on the deck. How easy these angel white wood shavings can go up. Lie here in this rattling and wrenched airplane. Lie still as you can, damn fool. Yup. They've conned you. Conned you again. Richard Halliburton, Lowell Thomas, Rover and Motor Boys, jaundiced stacks of National Geographics up in Hogan's room must have all lied to him, and there was no one then, not even a colonial ghost in the attic, to tell him different. Bump, skid, slew, pancake landing, fucking washouts from kite flying school, gray Swiss dawn light through little windows, and every joint, muscle, and bone in Slothrop is sore. It's time to punch back in. He gets off the plane without incident, mingling into a yawning, sour flock of early passengers, delivery agents, airfield workers. Quantin in the early morning. Shocking green hills one side, brown city on the other. Pavements are slick and wet. Clouds blow slowly in the sky. Mont Blanc says hi. Lake says howdy, too. Slothrop buys 20 cigarettes in a local paper, asks directions, gets in a tram that comes and with cold air through doors and windows to wake him up, goes rolling into the city of peace. He's to meet his Argentine contact at the Café L'Eclipse, well off the trolley lines, down a cobblestone street and into a tiny square surrounded by vegetable and fruit stalls under beige awnings, shops, other cafes, window boxes, clean-hosed sidewalks. Dogs go running in and out of the alleys. Slothrop sits with coffee, croissants, and newspaper. Presently the overcast burns off. The sun throws shadows across the square nearly to where he's sitting with all the antennas out. Nobody seems to be watching. He waits. Shadows retreat, sun climbs, then begins to fall. At last his man shows up, exactly as described. Suit of Buenos Aires daytime black, mustache, gold-rimmed glasses, and whistling an old tango by Juan de Arienzo. Slothrop makes a show of searching all his pockets, comes up with the foreign bills Qualidossi told him to use, frowns at it, gets up, goes over. Como no, senor. No problem changing a 50-peso note. Offering a seat, coming out with currency, notebooks, cards. Pretty soon the tabletop's littered with pieces of paper that eventually get sorted back into pockets so that the man has Squalidozzi's message and Slothrop has one to bring back to Squalidozzi, and that's that. Back to Zurich on an afternoon train, sleeping most of the way. He gets off at Schlieren, some ungodly dark hour, just in case they're watching the Bahnhof in town, hitches a ride in as far as the St. Peterhofstadt. Its great clock hangs over him and empty acres of streets in what he now reads as dumb malignity. It connects to Ivy League quadrangles in his distant youth, clock towers lit so dim the hour could never be read, and a temptation never so strong, though, as now to surrender to the darkening year, to embrace what he can of real terror to the hour without a name, unless it's... No, no. It was vanity. Vanity as his Puritan forerunners had known it. Bones and heart alert to nothing. Nothing underneath the college saxophones melding sweetly. White blazers lipsticked about the lapels. Smoke from nervous Fatimas. Castile soap vaporizing off of shining hair and mint kisses and dewed carnations. It was being come for just before dawn by pranksters younger than he, dragged from bed, blindfolded. Hey, Reinhardt! Led out into the autumnal cold, shadows and leaves underfoot, and the moment then of doubt, the real possibility that they are something else, that none of it was real before this moment, only elaborate theater to fool you. But now the screen has gone dark, and there is absolutely no more time left. The agents are here for you at last. What better place than Zurich to find vanity again? It's Reformation country, Zwingli's town, the man at the end of the encyclopedia, and stone reminders are everywhere. Spies and big business in their element move tirelessly among the grave markers. Be assured there are ex-young men here in this very city, faces Slothrop used to pass in the quads, who got initiated at Harvard into the Puritan mysteries, who took oaths in dead earnest to respect and to act always in the name of vanitas, emptiness, their ruler, who now, according to life plan, such and such have come to Switzerland to work for Alan Dulles and his intelligence network, which operates these days under the title Office of Strategic Services. But to initiates, OSS is also a secret acronym. As a mantra for times of immediate crisis, they have been taught to speak inwardly, us. Us, the late corrupt Dark Age Latin word for bone. Next day, when Slothrop meets Mario Schweitzer at the Stregli to front him half his fee, he asks also for the location of Yamp's grave. And that's where they arrange to close the deal up in the mountains. Squalidozzi doesn't show up at the Kronenhalle, or the Odeon, or any place Slothrop will think to look in the days that follow. Disappearances in Zurich are not unheard of. But Slothrop will keep going back just in case. The message is in Spanish. He can't make out more than a word or two, but he'll hold on to it. There might be a chance to pass it on. And, well, the anarchist persuasion appeals to him a little. Back when Shays fought the federal troops across Massachusetts, there were Slothrop regulators patrolling Berkshire for the rebels, wearing sprigs of hemlock in their hats so you could tell them from the government soldiers. Federals stuck a tatter of white paper in theirs. Slothrops in those days were not yet so much involved with paper and the wholesale slaughtering of trees. They were still for the living green, against the dead white. Later they lost or traded away knowledge of which side they'd been on. Tyrone here has inherited most of their bland ignorance on the subject. Back behind him now, wind blows through Yamp's crypt. Slothrop's been camped here these past few nights, nearly out of money, waiting for word from Schweitzer. Out of the wind, huddled inside a couple of Swiss Army blankets he managed to promote, he's even been able to sleep right on top of Mr. Emipolex. The first night he was afraid to fall asleep, afraid of a visit from Jampf, whose German scientist mind would be battered by death to only the most brute reflexes, no way to appeal to the dumb and grinning evil of the shell that was left. Voices twittering with moonlight around his image as step by step he, it, the repressed, approaches. Wait a minute, up out of sleep, face naked, turning to the foreign gravestones. The what? What was it? Back again, almost to it, up again, up and back, that way most of the early night. There's no visit. It seems Jampf is only dead. Slothrop woke next morning, feeling, in spite of an empty stomach and a runny nose, better than he had in months. Seemed like he'd passed a test. Not somebody else's test, but one of his own for a change. The city below him, bathed now in a partial light, is a necropolis of church spires and weathercocks, white castle-keep towers, broad buildings with mansard roofs and windows glimmering by thousands. This forenoon, the mountains are as translucent as ice. Later in the day, they will be blue heaps of wrinkled satin. The lake is mirror-smooth, but mountains and houses reflected down there remain strangely blurred, with edges fine and combed as rain. A dream of Atlantis, of the Sugental. Toy villages, desolate city of painted alabaster. Slothrop hunkers down here in the cold curve of a mountain trail, packing and lobbing idle snowballs. Not much to do around here but smoke the last butt of what, for all he knows, is the last lucky strike in all Switzerland. Footfalls down the trail, clinking galoshes. It is Mario Schweitzer's delivery boy with a big fat envelope. Slothrop pays him, chisels a cigarette and some matches, and they part. Back to the crypt, Slothrop relights a small pile of kindling and pine boughs, warms up his hands, and begins to thumb through the data. The absence of Jampf surrounds him like an odor, one he knows but can't quite name, an aura that threatens to go epileptic any second. The information is here, not as much as he wanted, oh, how much was that, but more than he hoped. Being one of those practical Yankees, in the weeks ahead, in those very few moments, he'll be allowed to wallow in his past. He may even have time to wish he hadn't read any of it. Mr. Pointsman has decided to spend Whitsun by the sea. Feeling a bit megalo these days, nothing to worry about really, never gets worse than, oh, perhaps the impression, whilst zooming along through the corridors of the White Visitation, that all the others seem to be frozen in attitudes of unmistakable Parkinsonism, with himself the only alert, unpalsied one remaining. It is peacetime again now. No room for the pigeons in Trafalgar Square on VE night. Everyone at the facility that day mad drunk and hugging and kissing, except for the Blavatskyan wing of Psi section, who were off on a White Lotus Day pilgrimage to 19 Avenue Road, St. John's Wood. Now there's time again for holidays. Though Pointsman does feel a certain obligation to go relax, there is also, of course, the crisis. A leader must show self-possession, up to and including a holiday mood in the midst of crisis.
There's now been no word of Slothrop for nearly a month, since the fumbling asses in military intelligence. Pointsman is a bit browned off with the firm. His clever strategy appears to have failed. In first discussions with Clive Mossmoon and the others, it seemed foolproof to let Slothrop escape from the casino Hermann Göring and then rely on Secret Service to keep him under surveillance instead of Pisces. An economy move. The surveillance bill is the most excruciating thorn in the crown of funding problems he seems condemned to wear for the duration of this project. Damned funding is going to be his downfall if Slothrop doesn't drive him insane first. Poitzman has blundered. Hasn't even the Tennysonian comfort of saying someone has blundered. No, it was he, and he alone, who authorized the Anglo-American team of Harvey Speed and Floyd Perdue to investigate a random sample of Slothropian sex adventures. Budget was available, and what harm could it do? They went off practically skipping, obsessive as munchkins, out into the erotic poisson. Don Giovanni's map of Europe, 640 in Italy, 231 in Germany, 100 in France, 91 in Turkey, but in Spain, 1003 is Slothrop's map of London. And the two gumshoes become so infected with the prevailing fondness out here for mindless pleasures that they presently are passing whole afternoons sitting out in restaurant gardens, dawdling over chrysanthemum salads and mutton casseroles, or larking at the fruit mongers. Hey, Speed, look, cantaloupes. I haven't seen one of them since the third term. Wow, smell this one. It's beautiful. Say, how about a cantaloupe, Speed, huh? Come on. Excellent idea, Perdue, excellent. Well, you pick out the one you want, okay?
The one?
Yeah, this is the one. Turning it to show him as the faces of threatened girls are roughly turned by villains. That I picked out, see? But I thought we were both going to. Gesturing feebly toward what he still cannot quite accept as Perdue's melon, in whose intaglio net now, as among craters of the pale moon, a face is indeed emerging, the face of a captive woman with eyes cast downward, lids above as smooth as Persian ceilings. Well, no, I usually... This is embarrassing for Perdue. It's like being called on to justify eating an apple or even popping a grape into your mouth. Just, well, sort of eat them whole, you know? Chuckling in what he hopes is a friendly way to indicate politely the social oddness of this discussion. But the chuckle is taken the wrong way by Speed, taken as evidence of mental instability in this slightly buck-toothed and angular American who is dancing now from stoop to English stoop, lank as a street puppet in the wind. Shaking his head, he nevertheless selects his own whole cantaloupe, realizes he's been left to pay the bill, which is exorbitant, and goes skipping off after Perdue, hippity-hop, both of them tra-la-la-la, slam right into another dead end. Jenny? No Jenny here. Jennifer, perhaps? Genevieve? Ginny. It could have been misspelled. Virginia? If you gentlemen are looking for a good time... Her grin, her red, maniacally good morning, and I mean good grin, is wide enough to hold them both right, shivering, smiling here, and she's old enough to be their mother, their joint mother, combining the worst traits of Mrs. Perdue and Mrs. Speed. In fact, she is turning now into just that, even as they watch. These wrecked seas are full of temptresses. It's watery and wanton out here, all right. As the two gawking, soft-boiled Seamuses are drawn along into her aura, winking right here in the street, brassy with henna glare, with passion flowers on rayon, just before the last stumbling surrender into the lunacy of her purple eyes, they allow themselves, for the sinful tickle of it, a last thought of the project they're supposed to be here on, Slothropian Episodic Zone, Weekly Historical Observations, says who. A thought that comes running out in the guise of a clown, a vulgar loose-ends clown bespangled with wordless jokes about body juices. Bald-headed, an amazing fall of nose hair out both nostrils, which he has put into braids and tied with acid-green bows. A scrabbling dash now out past sandbags and falling curtain, trying to get back his breath, to garble to them in a high unpleasant screech, "No Jenny, no Sally W., no Sibylle, no Angela, no Catherine, no Lucy, no Gretchen. When are you going to see it? When are you going to see it?" No Darlene, either. That came in yesterday. They traced the name as far as the residence of a Mrs. Quod. But the flashy young divorcee never, she declared, even knew that English children were named Darlene. She was dreadfully sorry. Mrs. Quode spent her days lounging about a rather pedicured Mayfair address, and both investigators felt relieved to be out of the neighborhood.
When are you going to see it?
Pointsman sees it immediately. But he sees it in the way you would walking into your bedroom to be jumped on out of a bit of penumbra on your ceiling by a gigantic moray eel, its teeth and full imbecile death smile breathing in its fall onto your open face, a long human sound that you know horribly to be a sexual sigh. That is to say, Pointsman avoids the matter as reflexively as he would any nightmare. Should this one turn out not to be a fantasy but real, well, the data so far are incomplete. This ought to be prominently stressed in all statements. We admit that the early data seem to show, remember, act sincere, a number of cases where the names on Slothrop's map do not appear to have counterparts in the body of fact we've been able to establish along his timeline here in London. Established so far, that is. These are mostly all first names, you see. The X's without the Y's, so to speak, ranks without files. Difficult to know how far into one far enough really is. And what if many, even if most of the Slothropian stars are proved some distant day to refer to sexual fantasies instead of real events? This would hardly invalidate our approach any more than it did young Sigmund Freud's back there in old Vienna, facing a similar violation of probability. All those Papi has raped me stories which might have been lies evidentially, but were certainly the truth clinically. You must realize we are concerned at Pisces with a rather strictly defined clinical version of truth. We seek no wider agency in this. So far it is Pointsman's burden alone. The solitude of a Fuhrer, he feels himself growing strong in the rays of this dark companion to his public star now on the rise, but he doesn't want to share it. No, not just yet. Meetings of the staff, his staff, grow worse and worse than useless. They bog down into endless arguments about trivia, whether or not to rename Pisces now that the surrender has been expedited, what sort of letterhead, if any, to adopt. The representative from Shell Mech's house, Mr. Dennis Joint, wants to put the program under Special Projectiles Operations Group, SPOG, as an adjunct of the British rocket scavenging effort Operation Backfire, which is based out of Cuxhaven on the North Sea. Every other day brings a fresh attempt from some quarter to reconstitute or even dissolve Pisces. Pointsman is finding it much easier of late to slip into a l'état c'est moi frame of mind. Who else is doing anything? Isn't he holding it all together, often with nothing beyond his own raw will? Shelmeck's house, naturally, is frantic about Slothrop's disappearance. Here's a man running loose who knows everything it's possible to know, not only about the A4, but about what Great Britain knows about the A4. Zurich teams with Soviet agents. What if they've already got Slothrop? They took Peenemünde in the spring. It appears now they will be given the central rocket works at Nordhausen, another of the dealings at Yalta. At least three agencies, Viam, Tagi, and NISO, plus engineers working out of other commissariats, are even now in Soviet-occupied Germany with lists of personnel and equipment to be taken east. Inside the Schaeff sphere of influence, American Army Ordnance and a host of competing research teams are all busy collecting everything in sight. They've already rounded up von Braun and 500 others and interned them at Garmisch. What if they get hold of Slothrop? There have also been, aggravating the crisis, defections. Rollo Grost assumed back into the Society for Psychical Research. Treacle setting up a practice. Myron Grunton, again a full-time wireless personality. Mexico has begun to grow distant. The Borgesius woman still performs her nocturnal duties, but with the brigadier ill now, has the old fool been forgetting his antibiotics? Must Pointsman do everything? She's beginning to fret. Of course, Gyesa Rozavoldi is still with the project. A fanatic. Rozavoldi will never leave. So, a holiday by the sea. For political reasons, the party is made up of Pointsman, Mexico, Mexico's girl, Dennis Joint, and Katya Borgesius. Pointsman wears rope-soled shoes, his pre-war bowler, and a rare smile. The weather is not ideal, an overcast, a wind that will be chilly by mid-afternoon. A smell of ozone blows up from the Dodgem cars out of the gray steel girderwork along the promenade, along with smells of shellfish on the barrows and of salt sea. The pebbled beach is crowded with families, shoeless fathers in lounge suits and high white collars. mothers in blouses and skirts, startled out of war-long camphor sleep, kids running all over in sunsuits, nappies, rompers, short pants, knee socks, Eton hats. There are ice creams, sweets, cokes, cockles, oysters, and shrimps with salt and sauce. The pinball machines writhe under the handling of fanatical servicemen and their girls, throwing body English, cursing, groaning as the bright balls drum down the wood obstacle courses through ka-chongs, flashing lights, thudding flippers. The donkeys hee-haw and shit. The children walk in it and their parents scream. Men sag in striped canvas chairs talking business, sports, sex, but most usually politics. An organ grinder plays Rossini's overture to La Gazza Ladra, which, as we shall see later in Berlin, marks a high point in music which everybody ignored, preferring Beethoven, who never got further than statements of intention. And here, without snare drums or the sonority of brasses, the piece is mellow, full of hope, promising lavender twilights, stainless steel pavilions, and everyone elevated at last to aristocracy and love without payment of any kind. It was Pointsman's plan today not to talk shop, but to let the conversation flow more or less organically. Wait for others to betray themselves. But there is shyness or constraint among them all. Talk is minimal. Dennis Joint is watching Katya with a horny smile, with now and then a suspicious stare for Roger Mexico. Mexico, meantime, has his troubles with Jessica more and more often these days, and at the moment the two aren't even looking at each other. Katya Borgesius has her eyes far out to sea, and there is no telling what is going on with this one. In some dim way, Pointsman, though he can't see that she has any leverage at all, is still afraid of her. There is still a lot he doesn't know. Perhaps what's bothering him most right now is her connection, if any, with Pirate Prentice. Prentice has been down to the White Visitation several times, asking rather pointed questions about her. When Pisces recently opened its new branch office in London, which some wag, probably that young imbecile Webley Silvernail, has already dubbed 12th House, Prentice began hanging heavily around up there, romancing secretaries, trying for a peep into this file or that. What's up? What afterlife have the firm found this side of VE Day? What does Prentice want? What's his price? Is he in love with La Borgesius here? Is it possible for this woman to be in love? Love? Oh, it's enough to make you scream. What would her idea of love be? Mexico? Grabbing the young statistician's arm. Eh? Roger interrupted, eyeing a lovely, looks a bit like Rita Hayworth in a one-piece floral number with straps that X across her lean back. Mexico, I think I am hallucinating. Oh, really? You think you are? What are you seeing? Mexico, I see. What do you mean, what am I seeing, you nit? It's what I'm hearing. Well, what are you hearing, then? A touch of peevishness to Roger now. Right now I'm hearing you saying, what are you hearing, then? And I don't like it. Why not? Because unpleasant as this hallucination is, I find I still much prefer it to the sound of your voice. Now, this is odd behavior from anybody, but from usually correct Mr. Pointsman, it is enough to stop this mutually paranoid party in their tracks. Nearby is a Wheel of Fortune with Lucky Strike packs, Cupid dolls, and candy bars stuffed among the spokes. I say, what do you think? Blonde hail fellow Dennis Joint nudges Katya with an elbow as broad as a knee. In his profession, he has learned to make instant evaluations of those with whom he deals. He judges old Katya here to be a jolly girl out for a spot of fun. Yes, leadership material here, definitely. Hasn't he gone a bit mental suddenly? Trying to keep his voice down, grinning in athletic paranoia vaguely over in the peculiar Pavlovian's direction, not right at him, you understand. Eye contact might be suicidal folly given his state of mind. Meantime, Jessica has gone into her Fay Wray number. This is a kind of protective paralysis, akin to your own response when the moray eel jumps you from the ceiling. But this is for the fist of the eight, for the lights of electric New York white weighing into the room you thought was safe, could never be penetrated. For the coarse black hair, the tendons of need, of tragic love. Yeah, well, as film critic Mitchell Prettyplace puts it in his definitive 18-volume study of King Kong, you know, he did love her, folks. Proceeding from this thesis, it appears that Prettyplace has left nothing out, every shot, including outtakes, raked through for every last bit of symbolism, exhaustive biographies of everyone connected with the film, extras, grips, lab people, even interviews with King Kong cultists, who, to be eligible for membership, must have seen the movie at least 100 times and be prepared to pass an 8-hour entrance exam. And yet,
And yet there is Murphy's Law to consider, that brash Irish proletarian restatement of Gödel's theorem, when everything has been taken care of, when nothing can go wrong or even surprise us, something will. So the permutations and combinations of puddings, things that can happen in European politics for 1931, the year of Gödel's theorem, don't give Hitler an outside chance. So, when laws of heredity are laid down, mutants will be born. Even as determinist a piece of hardware as the A4 rocket will begin spontaneously generating items like the Esgeret, Clothrop thinks he's chasing like a grail. And so, too, the legend of the black scape ape we cast down like Lucifer from the tallest erection in the world has come in the fullness of time to generate its own children, running around inside Germany even now, the Schwarzkommando, whom Mitchell Prettyplace even could not anticipate. At Pisces, it is widely believed that the Schwarzkommando have been summoned in the way demons may be gathered in, called up to the light of day and earth by the now defunct Operation Blackwing. You can bet Psy Section was giggling about this for a while. Who could have guessed there'd be real black rocket troops? That a story made up to scare last year's enemy should prove to be literally true, and no way now to stuff them back in the bottle or even say the spell backward. No one ever knew the complete spell. Different people knew different parts of it. That's what teamwork is. By the time it occurs to them to look back through the most secret documentation surrounding Operation Blackwing, to try and get some idea of how this all might have happened, they will find, curiously, that certain critical documents are either missing or have been updated past the end of the operation, and that it is impossible at this late date to reconstruct the spell at all. Though there will be the usual elegant and bad poetic speculation. Even earlier speculation will be locked and tranquilized. Nothing will remain, for example, of the tentative findings of Freudian Edwin Treacle and his lot, who toward the end even found themselves at odds with their own minority, the psychoanalytic wing of Psy Section. It began as a search for some measurable basis for the common experience of being haunted by the dead. After a while, colleagues began to put in chits requesting they be transferred out. Unpleasantries such as, "It's beginning to sound like the Tavistock Institute around here," began muttering up and down the basement halls. Palace revolts, many of them conceived in ornamentally splendid flashes of paranoia, brought locksmiths and welders in by droves, led to mysterious shortages of office supplies, even of water and heat, none of which kept Treacle and lot from carrying on in a Freudian, not to mention Jungian, frame of mind. Word of the Schwarzkommando's real existence reached them a week before VE Day. Individual events, who really said what to whom, have been lost in the frenzy of accusation, crying, nervous breakdowns, and areas of bad taste that followed. Someone remembers Gavin Trefoil, face as blue as Krishna, running through the topiary trees stark naked, and Treacle chasing him with an axe, screaming, "Giant ape, I'll show you a giant ape, all right!" Indeed, he would show the critter to many of us, though we would not look. In his innocence, he saw no reason why co-workers on an office project should not practice self-criticism with the same rigor as revolutionary cells do. He had not meant to offend sensibilities, only to show the others, decent fellows all, that their feelings about blackness were tied to feelings about shit, and feelings about shit to feelings about putrefaction and death. It seemed to him so clear. Why wouldn't they listen? Why wouldn't they admit that their repressions had, in a sense that Europe in the last weary stages of its perversion of magic has lost, had incarnated real and living men, likely, according to the best intelligence, in possession of real and living weapons, as the dead father who never slept with you, Penelope, returns night after night to your bed, trying to snuggle in behind you, or as your unborn child wakes you, crying in the night and you feel its ghost lips at your breast. They are real, they are living, as you pretend to scream inside the fist of the ape. But looking over now at the much more likely candidate, cream-skinned Katya under the wheel of fortune, who is herself getting ready now to bolt down the beach and into the relative calm of the switchback railway. Pointsman is hallucinating. He has lost control. Pointsman is supposed to have absolute control over Katya. Where does this leave her? In a control that is out of control. Not even back in the leather and pain of Gemütlich Captain Blissero's world has she felt as terrified as now. Roger Mexico is taking it personally. Oh, I say, only trying to help. What the somewhat disconnected Mr. Pointsman has been hearing all this time is a voice strangely familiar, a voice he once imagined a face in a well-known news photograph from the war to have. Here's what you have to do. You need Mexico now more than ever. Your winter anxieties about the end of history seem now all well comforted to rest, part of your biography now like any old bad dream. But like Lord Acton always says, history is not woven by innocent hands. Mexico's girlfriend there is a threat to your whole enterprise. He will do anything to hold on. Scowling and even cursing him, she will nevertheless seduce him away into a civilian fog bank in which you will lose him and never find him, not unless you act now, Pointsman. Operation Backfire is sending ATS girls out to the zone now. Rocket girls, secretarial and even minor technical duties at the Cuxhaven test range. You have only to drop a word to Spog through Dennis Joint here, and Jessica Swanlake is out of your way. Mexico may complain for a while, but all the more reason for him, given the proper direction, to lose himself in his work, eh? Remember the eloquent words of Sir Dennis Nayland Smith to young Alan Sterling, whose fiancée is in the clutches of the insidious yellow adversary. I have been through the sort of fires which are burning you now, Sterling, and I have always found that work was the best ointment for the burns. And we both know what Nayland Smith represents, don't we? I do, says Pointsman aloud, but I can't really say that you do, can I, if I don't even know who you are, you see. This strange outburst does not reassure Pointsman's companions. They begin to edge away in definite alarm. We should find a doctor, murmurs Dennis Joint, winking at Katya like a blonde crew-cut Groucho Marx. Jessica, forgetting her sulk, takes Roger's arm. You see, the voice starts up again. She feels that she's protecting him against you. How many chances does one get to be a synthesis, Pointsman? East and West, together in the same bloke. You can not only be Nayland Smith, giving a young lad in a funk wholesome advice about the virtues of work, but you also, at the same time, get to be Fu Manchu, eh? The one who has the young lady in his power. How's that? Protagonist and antagonist in one. I'd jump at it if I were you. Pointsman is about to retort something like, but you're not me. Only he sees how the others all seem to be goggling at him. Oh, ha, ha! He says instead, talking to myself here, a little sort of eccentricity. Yang and Yin, whispers the voice. Yang and Yin.
3. In the zone. Toto, I have a feeling we're not in Kansas anymore. Dorothy arriving in Oz. We are safely past the days of the Ice Heiligen, St. Pancratius, St. Servatius, St. Bonifacius, de Calte Sophie. They hover in clouds above the vineyards, holy beings of ice, ready with a breath and intention to ruin the year with frost and cold. In certain years, especially war years, they are short on charity, peevish, smug in their power, not quite saintly or even Christian. The prayers of growers, pickers, and wine enthusiasts must reach them, but there's no telling how the ice saints feel. Coarse laughter, pagan annoyance. Who understands this rear guard who preserve winter against the revolutionaries of May? They found the countryside this year at peace by a scant few days. Already vines are beginning to grow back over dragons' teeth, fallen shtukas, burned tanks. The sun warms the hillsides, the rivers fall bright as wine. The saints have refrained. Nights have been mild, the frost didn't come. It is the spring of peace, the vintage, God granting at least 100 days of sun, will be fine. Nordhausen puts less credence in the ice saints than do wine regions farther south, but even here the season looks promising. Rain blows, scattering out over the town as Slothrop comes in the early morning, bare feet, blistering and re-blistering, cooled here in the wet grass. There's sunlight up on the mountains. His shoes got lifted by some DP with fingers lighter than dreams on one of the many trains since the Swiss border, someplace rolling across Bavaria, fast asleep. Whoever it was left a red tulip between Slothrop's toes. He has taken it for a sign, a reminder of Katya. Signs will find him here in the zone, and ancestors will reassert themselves. It's like going to that darkest Africa to study the natives there and finding their quaint superstitions taking you over. In fact, funny thing, Strathrop just the other night ran into an African, the first one he ever met in his life. Their discussion on top of the freight car in the moonlight lasted only a minute or two. Small talk for the sudden background departure of Major Duane Marvey over the side bounce-clatter down the cobbled fill into the valley. Well, certainly nothing was said then of any Herrero beliefs about ancestors. Yet he feels his own, stronger now as borders fall away and the zone envelops him, his own wasps in buckled black, who heard God clamoring to them in every turn of a leaf or cow loose among apple orchards in autumn. Signs of Katya. And doubles, too. One night, he sat in a children's playhouse on an abandoned estate, feeding a fire from the hair of a blonde doll with lapis lazuli eyes. He kept those eyes. A few days later, he traded them for a ride and half a boiled potato. Dogs barked far away. Summer wind blew in the birches. He was on one of the main arterials of the spring's last dissolution and retreat. Somewhere nearby, one of Major General Kammler's rocket units had together found corporate death, leaving in their crippled military rage pieces, modules, airframe sections, batteries rotting, paper secrets rained back into slurry. Strathrop follows. Any clue is good enough to hop a train for. The doll's hair was human. The smell of it burning is horrible. Strathrop hears movement from the other side of the fire, a ratcheting noise. He grabs his blanket, ready to vault away out the empty window frame, expecting a grenade. Instead, one of these little brightly painted German toys, an orangutan on wheels, comes kee-kee-keeing into the firelight, spastic, head lolling, face in an idiot's grin, steel knuckles scraping the floor. It rolls nearly into the fire before the clockwork runs down, the wagging head coming to dead center to stare at Strathrop. He feeds the fire another tuft of golden hair. Evening. Laughter somewhere. A child, but old laughter. Come on out, I'm harmless. The ape is followed by a tiny black crow with a red beak, also on wheels, hopping, cawing, flapping metal wings. End of side 9. To continue, turn the cassette over.